This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award. Are you doing excellent research that deserves recognition? The NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award recognizes bold young researchers who ask fundamental questions at the intersection of the life and social sciences. Researchers who take risks to address relevant and exciting questions with creative approaches, regardless of the research outcome. Submissions are due May 15th. Visit science.org/NOMIS, that's NOMIS, to apply today. Welcome to the Science Podcast for January 3rd, 2014. I'm Sarah Crespi. This week's show focuses on the great stone monuments of prehistoric Britain, and we hear from David Grimm with the latest stories from our daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Stonehenge is the most famous monument from the Neolithic era, but it was actually constructed somewhat later than some of its lesser-known brethren, like the Ring of Brodgar in Orkney. I spoke with Michael Balter about recent evidence from new digs and new dating techniques that are filling in the details on the spread of these large stone works and providing some new ideas about their purpose.
Well, the story in science focuses on the monuments that are in the UK, but they are not the first ones. The megalithic monuments began to arise as farming spread across Europe, but they tend to be concentrated mostly in coastal areas. So some of the most famous ones are in Brittany and France and so forth, and some of those are as old as 6,000 years. What happened was is that when farming spread to the UK, you began to get monuments, megalithic monuments, that were different than the ones on the continent that seemed to be expressing very special cultural manifestations in the British Isles. And that includes very famous ones like Stonehenge, like Avebury, which is very near Stonehenge, Newgrange, a huge burial tomb in Ireland. And you began to get kind of a uniquely British stamp on these megaliths. And that probably started sometime after 6,000 years ago.
And one of the big challenges of studying these monuments is getting dates out of stones. It's really difficult. What's changed?
Well, it's absolutely true that you can't date a stone normally, certainly not by radiocarbon dating, which requires organic material such as bone or charcoal, things like that. Our understanding of megalithic monuments and the evolution, the sort of the cultural evolution of their building and of their construction, has benefited from changes in radiocarbon dating sort of more generally. And that has to do with greater precision of individual dates, new techniques that allow us to take smaller samples. It has also stemmed from being more particular about the kind of samples that we use, making sure that they are very closely associated with the stones, either because they come from a socket that a stone was in or from a burial that's known to be associated with a stone. And then finally, there's a statistical method called Bayesian statistics, which allows us to make sort of better guesses about what the order of radiocarbon dates at an archaeological site is. So rather than just taking every individual date on its own, you organize or you arrange the dates in a statistical way so that you get the most likely sequence of them. And that allows you to kind of eliminate dates that don't really work or may have errors in them.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of these terms that you introduce in your story. What's a henge and what's a menhir? Those are kinds of monuments?
Yes. Well, a henge is something that's unique to Britain. And you've heard the term, of course, Stonehenge. Mm-hmm. And usually when people think of henges, they think of stone circles like Stonehenge and other ones. A henge actually technically is a circular bank and a circular ditch that run concentrically to each other. So a normal henge is a bank, in other words, just sort of an earthwork that can be, well, the biggest one at Durrington Walls, which is close to Stonehenge, is 500 meters across.
Wow.
And normally you then have a ditch that runs just on the interior of the bank. And so it's kind of a bank and ditch concentric circle. Sometimes they're a little bit oval. And then you can oftentimes have a stone circle in the middle of that, but not always. There are henges that don't have stone circles at all.
And what about this other term, the menhir?
So menhir, the French pronunciation, yes. So menhir are basically is kind of the French word for a standing stone. And generally, this is one of the interesting differences between the continent and Britain, which is that in France and elsewhere in Western Europe, you tend to get a lot of sort of standing stones, sometimes aligned in very, very long rows that can go on for kilometers, like at Karnak in Brittany and other sites like that. In Britain, you start to get much more frequently stone circles in which the menhir or the standing stones can be of enormous size. I think the ones at Stonehenge are up to 45 tons or something like that. And they're arranged in more complex circles, other configurations that are quite unique to Britain, really, and sort of set British megaliths apart.
So the center of this change, this addition of stones and making them really large, seems to be Orkney. What makes researchers think that this is the source of these cultural innovations?
Okay, well, that's a really good question. Part of it has to do with the radiocarbon dating. There's no henge and stone circle monuments that are any earlier than the ones that are found on Orkney, some very famous ones like the Ring of Brodgar. None of these special UK or British style monuments any earlier than in Orkney. But because radiocarbon dating is approximate, there's another archaeological result that makes us think that Orkney came first, and that is a style of pottery called grooved ware pottery, which is pretty much what the term says, kind of pottery with very deep incised lines, which you definitely see first on Orkney and which is very closely associated with henge monuments. So the idea is that you had a cultural manifestation that began way up north in the islands north of Scotland and then spread to other parts of Britain. And the grooved ware pottery appears to go together with henges and with stone circles in kind of a cultural package.
And that's a pretty remote place. Why might things have actually started up there?
Well, it seems remote to us today, but it probably wasn't back during the early days of farming or the so-called early Neolithic period. Because if you look at a map, you'll see that Western Europe, Belgium, France, Northern France, even some parts of Germany and so forth, are actually kind of just right across the North Sea from Scotland. So it may really be that back in the early days of the spread of farming to the UK, to the British Isles, that Orkney was not as remote as it appears today. The other aspect of this is that Orkney appears to have been a very, and by Orkney I'm referring to about 70 islands, and they were quite fertile. They still are today, but they certainly were back in Neolithic or early farming times. And so in a lot of ways, they might have been a better target for farmers than some of the areas to further to the south.
Mm-hmm. And so we've talked a little bit about the origin of these monuments and their spread and what they're made of, but are there any hints about what these different structures were used for?
Okay, well, that's something that's really been kind of changing in recent years. It used to be that archaeologists would look at individual monuments. Let's take Stonehenge as an example, which we talk about quite a bit in the story. And you look at it, and you look at the stones, and you see, okay, was it an astronomical laboratory? Was it someplace where certain rituals took place? And we were looking at individual monuments. What has changed in recent years is that archaeologists are now looking at whole clusters, whole arrangements of monuments. So, for example, Stonehenge, although it's pretty spectacular and most visitors to the Salisbury Plain where it's located would tend to only go to Stonehenge, Just a few kilometers away, you have a huge Henge monument, the biggest one in all of the UK, 500 meters in diameter, which was clearly constructed around the same time and associated with Stonehenge. So Mike Parker Pearson at University College London has proposed and mounted quite a bit of evidence, which we discuss in the story, that Durrington Walls, this place just slightly to the northeast of Stonehenge, was kind of the land of the living, and that Stonehenge was the land of the dead. So Stonehenge, made of stone, tends to reflect ancestors, dead things, whereas wood and settlements and the types of things that you see just a few kilometers away tend to reflect living landscape. So what we have found out is that these two different kinds of monuments were linked together, and what links them is the Avon River, which flows very near both of them. And there's avenues that run from both Durrington Walls and from Stonehenge to the Avon River. And we provide a map in the story that readers can look at, and I think that there's a pretty convincing relationship between the two sort of spheres, the land of the living and the land of the dead.
And what about the monuments that are on Orkney Islands? Are those similarly arranged?
Well, in Orkney, most of the most famous monuments, including the Ness of Brodgar, which is the one that we talk about quite a bit, this cluster of buildings, it's situated between two Henge monuments, one to the north of it, one to the south of it, along an isthmus that's really quite narrow. And what the archaeologists working there think, Nick Card, who's leading the dig there, and his colleagues up there, is that this isthmus kind of served as kind of a processional way, and that you perhaps either started from the north or you started from the south, and you paraded through, together with the people who were engaged in various rituals and ceremonies, along this landscape that was quite strictly controlled. And so it's a similar type of landscape to what you see at Durrington Walls and Stonehenge, but perhaps much more strictly controlled.
All right. Well, Michael Balter, thanks so much for talking with me.
Okay, you're very welcome.
Michael Balter is a contributing correspondent for Science. You can read his article and see a slideshow of images from these ancient sites in this week's issue. Finally today, David Grimm, editor for our daily news site, is here to talk about some recent stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on when whale watching turns deadly. Now, we're talking about deadly for the whales, right? Not the watchers?
That's right, deadly for the whales. But the watchers are the problem. It turns out, and this study was done in Hawaii, and it's a survey that spans a 36-year period from 1975 to 2011. And researchers have been noticing that the humpback whales in the area around the Hawaiian Islands, they seem to be getting hit a lot with commercial boats. But they weren't sure if there was actually an increase in these collisions and just exactly sort of what impact it was having on the whales. So that's what this new study was all about.
So is this happening because watchers are getting too close? Are they like getting right up above where the breeding and calving is going on?
Well, that was one thing that the researchers suspected, although the laws say that these whale watching boats have to maintain a 100-yard distance. So you wouldn't think that they're actually hitting these whales while they're actually watching them. And what the researchers discovered was actually two things. First of all, there has been an increase in the number of strikes, a number of ships hitting whales over this 36-year period. And what the researchers found was that the majority of the vessels that collided with the whales were these small to medium-sized boats, which are pretty much the size of whale-watching vessels. And actually what the researchers found was that these whales were not being hit while the whale-watching was taking place. So it seems like the commercial vessels are maintaining this 100-yard legal distance. The problem is that when they motor out to these areas where they want to observe the whales, they're traveling at very high speeds, and they seem to be hitting the whales in transit. So it's not like they're looking for whales, they get close to the whale, and then they hit the whale. It's when they are actually looking for whales in the first place, when they're getting out to their spot to look for whales, that's when they seem to be hitting the whales.
So I noticed there's a picture on the site of what this kind of damage looks like. What are we talking about here?
The one thing the researchers weren't able to quantify was the number of whales that are lethally wounded or killed by these strikes. And part of that is because it's hard to track sort of what the impact of these injuries are. Are these whales just sort of continuing on with life and just sort of suffering, or are the injuries so severe that it's either killing them slowly or preventing them maybe from feeding or mating and things like that? So the real impacts of these strikes are unclear. What all the researchers know at this point is that the strikes seem to be increasing.
Next up, we have a story on French fries made in outer space. So many questions immediately come to mind. Why is this something anyone wondered about? And more importantly, has anyone actually used a deep fryer in outer space?
Well, they actually didn't fry these potatoes in outer space, but what they wanted to do is see what would it be like to fry potatoes in outer space. And the reason they wanted to do this is because this is the European Space Agency, and they're looking for ways to improve the space food of the future. Everybody likes French fries, so it would be great to know how frying works in outer space. They actually didn't take a trip to outer space to fry these potatoes, but what they did was they stuck them in a spinning centrifuge that really increased the amount of gravity that these fries experience, up to 9 times Earth's gravity, and at the same time we're deep frying them in extra virgin olive oil.
So in the future, when we're choosing which planet to vacation on, which one will have the best French fries?
Well, what the researchers found is, first of all, that this increased gravity is actually pretty good for fries. It made them thick and crispy. It also shortened the frying time. And the ideal conditions were at about 3 times Earth's gravity, which is about what you find on Jupiter. So if you really want to make some good fries, you should travel to Jupiter.
Okay. Is this going to translate to kitchens here on planet Earth? Should we simulate excess gravity to improve crispiness of our fried products?
Well, it would certainly be a good marketing slogan, these fries were made in outer space. But unfortunately, there is some problem with the method, and that is that when they spin these fries in the centrifuges, there's water vapor that rushes out of the potato's pores, and that coalesces on the bottom of the fry, and that makes for a soggy bottom fry. So even though the rest of the fry is crispy, the bottoms are a bit soggy. So the technique still needs a little bit of refining.
Finally, we have a story on the breath of life and death. Okay, this story has kind of a menagerie of animals. Let's start with the tobacco hornworm. From its name, we can tell what it eats, but isn't nicotine an insecticide?
Yes, it is, but these little caterpillars have evolved a way to deal with this toxic substance. And in fact, they actually seem to be using it as a pretty powerful defense.
The mystery comes in now when the researchers look at low nicotine plants. What happens to the hornworms in that situation?
Well, when the hornworms feed on low nicotine plants, they seem to disappear. And the researchers suspected they're disappearing because they're being eaten by one of their chief predators, which is the wolf spider. And this is a pretty scary spider. You can see a picture of it on the site. And so they suspected that somehow when the caterpillars eat these nicotine-laced tobacco leaves in the wild, they're somehow using this nicotine that they're ingesting to ward off this spider.
So what do they think the mechanism is for using this toxic chemical to fend off wolf spiders?
Well, when the researchers looked a little closer, they looked at a gene called CYP6B46, which is active in the hornworm's gut. And what they found was that when they turned this gene off, there was higher nicotine levels in the hornworm's poop, which suggests that in the normal worms, this gene helps sequester this nicotine in the body. And then the researchers did one more thing. They basically administered a sort of insect version of a breathalyzer test with these caterpillars, and they found that they were exhaling nicotine breath every time they breathed out.
So they're not excreting it out of their skin or their feces, they're actually breathing it out. And how does the wolf spider react to that?
Well, this is what the researchers call toxic halitosis. And the wolf spiders did not like it. In fact, they ran away. You can actually see a video of this as well on the site. But even though it's a powerful defense, it only seems to work against the wolf spider. The researchers found that the hornworm's other predators, including big-eyed bugs, that's actually the name of the bug, and antlion larvae were not deterred by this toxic halitosis. So it's a good defense mechanism, but you can't scare everyone away with your bad breath.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about how jumping DNA in the brain may cause schizophrenia. Also a story about how global temperatures may rise by at least 4 degrees Celsius by the year 2100. For Science Insider, we've got a wrap-up of some of our favorite stories of the year. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, we're returning on January 9th with a live chat about how preserving carnivores can save ecosystems. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news, our upcoming live chats, and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. And that concludes the January 3rd, 2014 edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.